This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Andie MacDowell, stars with her daughter, Margaret Qualley, in the new Netflix series Maid. That's M-A-I-D. The series has apparently struck a nerve. In its first few weeks, it broke the record set by The Queen's Gambit as the most viewed limited series on Netflix. That record has since been broken by Squid Game. MacDowell co-starred in several films that hit the zeitgeist in the 90s, like Sex, Lies, and Videotape, Groundhog Day, and Four Weddings and a Funeral. She has a dual career as an actor and a model. She's been a model and spokesperson for L'Oreal Cosmetics for about 35 years. Let's start with Maid. It's loosely based on a memoir by Stephanie Land. Margaret Qualley plays Alex, a young mother of a 3-year-old child, who leaves her abusive alcoholic boyfriend and finds herself a single mother, broke, with no job, no home, and no one she can really rely on for help. Sometimes she reluctantly turns to her mother, Paula, Andie MacDowell's character, who appears to have an undiagnosed mental health disorder that leaves her in a pretty constant state of mania, talking nonstop about herself, her plans, and her passion for her own art. Alex, the daughter, has no job experience or special skills, so she takes the only job she's able to get, cleaning homes. But the cleaning agency she works for takes such a big percentage, Alex is basically getting minimum wage and having to pay for her own transportation and cleaning supplies. It doesn't leave enough money to rent a home, so she and her daughter spend time in a shelter for women who've been the victims of domestic violence. In this scene from the first episode, Alex is going to a job interview with the cleaning agency, Value Maids, and out of desperation, she asks her mother to watch her 3-year-old daughter, Maddie. Alex discovers that her mother's home is now an Airbnb with strangers living there, and her mother is now living in an RV in the woods with her boyfriend, Basil, who's played by Toby Levins. Outside the RV, there's a lot of Paula's paintings. Here's the scene.
Hi, Mom.
This is so exciting. I can't believe you came to see this. This is what all the brilliant painters and sculptors are doing in the art world right now. This is me stepping up to a global collective of minds.
Hey, Mom.
Archetypes. You know about archetypes. Hey. That's what I'm representing here in cobalt. The hero, the everyman, the mentor, the mystic, the
Mom.
Lover. Then, of course, there's
Mom.
Jungian archetypes.
Why didn't you tell me that you Airbnb'd your house?
I did, didn't I?
I just drove around to two campgrounds looking for you.
Well, honey, if you don't check in with me from time to time, that's on you.
I called you 14 times.
Is that Alexandra? Bloody hell. You disturbed the Airbnb people? Well, they're going to leave a review now, aren't they, you fanicle monster?
I can't deal with him today and his fake Australian accent. I can't do it.
Well, no, it's not fake. I was born in Perth, so.
Sure you were cilantro.
Don't call Basil cilantro, Alex. Our identity is subjective. He's Australian, I'm French Italian. In reality, we are both 100% Icelandic fairy.
Can I talk to you in private for a minute? I'm in a rush, Mom.
No, whatever you can say to me, you can say in front of him because he is my life and business partner.
What business? Renting your house out or making you sleep in an RV?
You're a malignant tumor.
Go put some shrimp on the Barbie, all right?
All right, Alex, enough. Out with it.
With,
out with it! You want something from me, so I just ask, what is it?
Can you watch Maddie for an hour? I have a job interview. It'll be 1 hour, 2 max.
Of course. She is my granddaughter. She is always welcome to experience me and be a part of my life.
Andie MacDowell, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on this new series. I think that last line says so much that she's always welcome to be with me and experience me. It's like, it's not about the grandmother wanting to experience her granddaughter. It's about the importance of the granddaughter experiencing the grandmother, your character. It's so narcissistic.
Yeah, it is very narcissistic. And, you know, it's at this moment, you meet Paula right in the beginning. She's definitely on one of her manic highs where she's extremely self-involved and consumed with herself. And I think it's really hard for her to relate with other people at that moment and easy to take advantage of. So you learn a lot about Paula in this opening scene, and her relationship with her daughter and her granddaughter.
What's it like to have your actual daughter, Margaret Qualley, in character? Is this the first time you've acted together?
It is the first time, and I was pleasantly surprised because I didn't think that it would happen. I thought eventually we may work together, but it was very important to her to carve her own career for herself and not to be seen as my daughter. She wanted to be seen as an individual, of course. We all want to be seen for our own gifts and talents, and she was comfortable. I think she has made done enough work. People have seen some of her work. Some of her work is a little bit more obscure, but she's even proud of what she's accomplished.
And I'll add, that includes being in The Leftovers and in...
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Oh, yeah, which is such a great film.
But she did some other kind of offbeat work, too, that she's, you know, in, within the business she's noted for. The public may not be conscious of it, but... She's already made her own name, so thank goodness for that, because she felt comfortable and told them that she felt that I would be great in this role. And I was truly honored. That's a really special thing to happen to a parent, to have a child trust them and to want them to play opposite them.
So she recommended you for the role?
Correct. She recommended me, yeah.
And was that because she knows that your mother had a mental health disorder?
I think that was part of it. You know, what she says to me now is that she thinks I'm a great actress, which is very, you know, it just makes me smile. It's very heartwarming to hear your child say something like that. But I do think there had to be a piece of it that she's asked me a lot of questions. She's very curious, and I think she wants to know about my history so that she can understand herself, because no matter what, when we come through something like that, I'm not cured, right? So there's going to be components to my own personality that you can see are injured. So she knows I'm an injured soul. So it's very close. You know, I'm not Paula. My mother's not Paula. But understanding the complexity of mental illness was something that I'm versed in. I've done my homework. I didn't have to go searching for it because I've been searching for these answers for a while.
How would you describe your mother's mental health disorder? Do you know if it was like bipolar or?
It was so complex, my mother, but I would love to really go back and try to research and find out, because my mother died when I was 23, and that's early. And she was a lovely person. She was a very complex person. But she was diagnosed with schizophrenia, but I don't think she was schizophrenic. That's the problem. I think you know, a lot of times people do these diagnoses because they, you know, maybe they're having a psychotic event, but they don't. Back then, this was in 1958 or 59. I don't even know exactly when it happened. It was shortly after I was born. So it could have been hormones involved, but they gave her shock treatments, and she was sent away for about 3 months to a place in Asheville, North Carolina. But when she came back, I mean, I never saw anything that looked like schizophrenia to me. So I don't know what happened exactly, except for little details that I have. But she became an alcoholic. That's how she wasn't on medication, and she didn't get any therapy because they just did things like that back then. It was like they would send women off and they were cured. And if women had a nervous breakdown, that's really how they used to define things like that, a nervous breakdown. Back then it was something that you hid, especially in a small town. It was just shameful. And she didn't really drink before she had the shock treatments, but she became an alcoholic afterwards. And I think that's how she dealt with it. She just drank to numb herself, really.
So you say that what you saw in your mother didn't seem like schizophrenia. What did you see?
I think she was just super depressed. She didn't have the mania, so she wouldn't stay up all night. I just think she was extremely depressed and couldn't get out of it. She definitely needed to have some kind of a chemical balance, something to help her balance out her chemicals. She wasn't like Paula, but I know what darkness is. There was a lot of darkness in my house due to the chaos and the depression and the drinking. And there was a lot of darkness, but I also saw darkness with my father. You know, I mean, my father was a beautiful man, but I saw him hit my mother when I was 4 and give her a bloody nose. So that goes back to this domestic violence is it happens. I mean, and he ended up leaving. He divorced shortly after. I just think he couldn't live in the chaos. He left me in the chaos, which I find fascinating. That's something I've really struggled with, because he got out. He took himself out. He got himself out, but he left us, which was fascinating to me.
Now, I read that when you were in your teens, you and your mother worked at the same McDonald's.
Yes, we did. Yep, we did.
But she got fired because she showed up drunk.
Correct.
What was it like for you to watch your mother be fired? And did you stay on the job after she was forced out?
What happened was my mother had lost her driver's license. She got a DUI. And I was driving her everywhere, or she would have to take a cab. And I knew she'd been drinking, but I couldn't tell if she was giving her, you know, gave her some coffee. I couldn't tell if they were going to be able to tell. And that was her last job before she died. But I went in and spoke to the manager, and I, you know, said, please give her the job back. And he said, I can't. So I quit. Had to quit. I mean, I wasn't going to keep working there after they fired her. But, you know, my mother got her degree in education. She was a bright woman. She loved to read. She never dated anyone after my father left. She had a very sad life. And people tried to help her. I got a letter from her when I had left to go to Paris. She would write me letters, and she wrote me one saying that she had quit drinking. But I never experienced that, because she was sober, I think, for about 6 months before she had her heart attack. She was sober for a very short period of time, and then she had a heart attack. But she did quit drinking, and I still have that letter that she wrote me, which is really heartbreaking.
What does it say?
That she was just how proud she was of me and what I was accomplishing, and that I deserved a mother that didn't drink.
Oh, so do you think she stopped drinking because of you?
That's what she said. But of course, you really stop drinking for your, you know, when you decide to stop drinking. That's what it is. I did an intervention for my mother when I was in the 12th grade. A failed intervention, unfortunately. But it was an intervention.
What did you do?
I called everybody and said, I can't leave her like this. We've got to do something. And we took her to my aunt's house in Columbia. Someone gave her a little bit of Valium, which I think was a huge mistake, because I couldn't communicate with her when we got to the place, and we just couldn't get her out of the car. I think if she had been clean, cold, sober, I could have gotten her in. And then we drove her to the state place. There's like the state mental health place on Bull Street in Columbia. And a doctor came down to the car and said, told us, it said, if you do not commit her today, she'll be dead in 5 years. But to commit her to the state institution, I don't know. We just couldn't do it. So we didn't do it. So we drove her home. And I remember we got a speeding ticket on the way home. That's when we finally cried. My sister and I got pulled over for a speeding ticket. It was just like, how bad can this day be? Then we got home, but I told her. I said, they said you're going to be dead in 5 years. And she quit drinking alcohol. She just drank wine, which I think it did make a difference. It's not like that pass out on the floor kind of drunk, you know. She drank lighter. That was the repercussion of that experience.
So as I recall, Sex, Lies, and Videotape came out in the very early years of the Sundance Film Festival, and it was a big hit at Sundance, and it was a big hit at, you know, art and indie houses around the country. How did the film change your life?
Oh, completely changed my life. Before Sex, Lies, and Videotape, nobody took me seriously. I was broken. I was trash, really. But after Sex, Lies, and Videotape, I became a well-known actress, and people perceived me as an actress, finally. And it made money. So that's like, if you do that, then it's a paradigm. Everything changes in your life. And I started being given jobs. I didn't even have to audition. It was amazing.
How did you get the part in Groundhog Day, where Bill Murray is a weatherman on Groundhog Day, and for some inexplicable reason, he keeps waking up day after day, and exactly the same thing happens day after day after day, and you play his producer? And you're a kind of like smart, sensitive, you know, really responsible person, and he's kind of like going crazy because no one else is experiencing this repetition day after day the way he is. So how did you get the role in that? That was such a big hit, and it's still a kind of touchstone film in so many ways, and people are always referring to things as being like Groundhog Day.
Yes, I love that movie. Harold Ramis saw me in a movie called The Object of Beauty that I did with John Malkovich. It wasn't a big movie, but it's a fun movie, very artsy, and he saw me in that. And of course, he knew me from Sex, Lies, and Videotape as well, but he liked what he saw in that movie. And then he wanted me to meet Bill Murray. So I basically, they do that quite often. It's like a chemistry read or whatever. They put two people in the same room and they see how they are together. If they find it's, you know, there's like electricity between these people or whatever. He wanted to see how we were together, and then I got the job.
Yeah, you were good together. What was it like working with Bill Murray? He's really so brilliant and so eccentric.
He's intense, I have to say. Bill's not the easiest person in the world I've ever met, but he's brilliant at what he does. And I felt it was really, really important for me not to lay on the comedy. He's so big. His comic nature and abilities are broad, and they're perfect, and they're really good. And I just played her real and real honest. I just came from her in a very honest, straightforward place and gave Bill all the space to do what Bill does. And the story unfolds, and you take this amazing trip. But yeah, I just think it's really a great movie, and it holds up. It's still a great movie. It's one of those classic films, I think, that you can always get pleasure out of it. Yeah, I'm really proud of that movie.
You know, you said that before Sex, Lies, and Videotape established you as a real actor, that you were kind of broken in the industry. And I think one of the reasons why is that your first film was Greystoke, which was a kind of backstory about Tarzan. And they dubbed your voice.
Yeah, that was horrible.
They had Glenn Close, like, dub your voice, and you didn't even know that that was happening.
That's correct.
Was that because of your Southern accent?
I guess. You know, I it was my very first movie. I was 23. No one ever said, we don't like the way you sound. So no one was ever clear or straightforward. So it was all unbeknownst to me. And it was really a hard thing to get out of, you know, to move beyond that. It was a decision for myself. I decided to do that. I make a joke out of it now because I tell people, I did it for my grandchildren that I still don't have.
But you did what? You did what?
I kept working. I had to, I could not let that be my legacy. I had to make it. Because I couldn't leave it like that. It was just too mortifying for that to be me, that was my story. And I just got into class. I worked really hard. I took classes, I watched movies, I worked with, you know, I spent money, good money with good coaching. I did a lot of coaching. I did voice lessons. I worked on my accent. I worked on just the resonance of my voice, of understanding where your voice comes from. I did everything.
I've heard so many actors say that they don't want or they didn't want their children to become actors because it's such a brutal profession with so much rejection, and so few people actually succeed when you look at all the people who try to become actors. So when your daughters first decided they wanted to go into the business, how did you feel about it?
I think mostly I was honored, because then I've always worried that I was away from them too much. And I would say to them, even when they were younger, I remember saying, particularly to Rainey, I can't do this anymore. I don't want to leave you. And she would go, please don't do that. I'm so proud of you. And it made me, then I started thinking, oh, okay, I'm teaching her that it's okay as a woman to do both. And, but it was still hard for me. You know, I felt guilt that I wasn't there all the time. So for me, it was another message that I hadn't done anything wrong, because I had this guilt complex. And that's the only perspective I thought of. I didn't think it through too much about rejection. I think I did talk to them about that. I talked to them about rejection, emphasis on weight. I hate that. You know, the how you're never going to feel good enough, beautiful enough, you know, how hard it is. I did tell them all that, and then they still wanted to do it. So, you know, I mean, they're happy. They're creative souls, creative beings, and they love what they do. So I understand that.
Well, I want to congratulate you on the success of Made and your performance in it. Thank you so much, Andy McDowell, for talking with us.
Thank you so much for talking to me. I'm honored to be on your show and to be speaking with you.
Andy McDowell stars with her daughter, Margaret Qualley, in the Netflix series Made. That's M-A-I-D. Louise Erdrich's new novel, The Sentence, takes place in a haunted bookshop over one very recent momentous year, from November 2019 to November 2020. Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, has a review.
The Sentence. It's such an unassuming title, and one that sounds like it belongs to a writing manual. But Louise Erdrich's latest is a deceptively big novel, various in its storytelling styles, ambitious in its immediacy. The Sentence is part of a vanguard of fall fiction by writers as disparate as Jodi Picoult, Gary Steingart, and Michael Connelly that tries to capture a splintering America during this long pandemic moment. For Erdrich, these strange times call for a ghost story that sometimes shifts into social realism, specifically into an account of the first months of the pandemic and the Black Lives Matter protests following the murder of George Floyd. An absorbing and unquiet novel, The Sentence, like the era we're living through, keeps us readers on the alert for the next improbable turn of events looming ahead of us. Erdrich's story starts in a slapstick crime mode, reminiscent of the novels of Elmore Leonard. Our narrator, a wry and resourceful woman named Tuki, recalls the misdeed that years earlier landed her in federal prison. Back then, Tuki drove a refrigerated grocery van, and she was asked by a grieving friend to steal the corpse of a recently deceased lover away from another woman's house. Tuki pulled off the snatch, but didn't notice that packets of cocaine were taped under the corpse's armpits. Arrested, Tuki took the fall. She tells us that the most important skill I gained in prison was to read with murderous attention. Mercifully released after 10 years, Tuki, who's Native American, landed a job at Birchbark Books in Minneapolis, the very same independent bookstore that Louise Erdrich owns in real life. Erdrich herself makes sporadic appearances here, but she's by no means the most jarring presence in the bookstore. In November 2019, Tuki ominously tells us, death took one of my most annoying customers, but she did not disappear. Flora was a white woman who patronized Birchbark, which specializes in Native books. Tuki calls her a stalker of all things Indigenous. At first, Flora's spectral activities are confined to footsteps and book reshufflings. But as the pandemic manifests itself in late winter of 2020, Flora's behavior grows more sinister. She wants to take possession of Tuki, who shifts from pissed off to petrified. There's also a suspicion that Flora's death may have been caused by the last sentence of the last book that she was reading. Throughout her long career, and most recently in her Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Night Watchman, Erdrich has interwoven the workings of things seen and unseen into her writing. White appropriation and the attempted decimation of Native identity have also been Erdrich's abiding subjects. But these unprecedented times call forth unusual strategies from writers. In the second half of the sentence, Erdrich layers on a style closer to creative nonfiction as Tuki witnesses the protests in Minneapolis following the killing of George Floyd. Here's Tuki describing her drive to work. "I passed burnt-out stores with walls like broken teeth. I passed a woman with a shopping cart full of children, pockets of peace, then smoking ruins, then tanks, and full-out soldiers in battle gear. I passed a popcorn store that was open, and I stopped to buy popcorn. The popcorn smell modified the smell of old tear gas, sour, musky chalk. I passed through darkness and got stopped by a cloud when I was nearly home. It was a cloud of emotion. I came to a halt and tried to breathe my way through the mist. It was cleared by the loud curfew alert on my phone." Though I've never put Norman Mailer and Louise Erdrich together before, sections like this one remind me of Mailer's 1968 masterpiece, The Armies of the Night, his so-called nonfiction novel chronicling an earlier time of fracture and unrest in America. All is tumultuous in the sentence, the spirits, the country, Erdrich's own style. One of the few constants this novel affirms is the power of books. Tuki recalls that everyone at Birchbark is delighted when bookstores are deemed an essential business during the pandemic, making books as important as food, fuel, heat, garbage collection, snow shoveling, and booze. No arguments here. And I'd add the sentence to the growing list of fiction that seems pretty essential for a deeper take on the times we're living through.
Our next guest, writer Gary Steingart, has appeared on Fresh Air 3 times before because he's a great storyteller and because his novels and a memoir have drawn on an eventful and at times difficult life. He comes from a Russian Jewish family, and many of his ancestors suffered terribly in World War II and in Stalin's labor camps. Steingart was born in the Soviet Union, and he and his parents emigrated to Queens, New York when he was 7. Adjusting to life in the U.S. wasn't easy as an anxious, asthmatic kid who didn't speak English or the other language he was being taught at a Hebrew day school. But he persevered, became a writer, and has published 5 successful books, many of them novels satirizing aspects of American life. His latest is set in the COVID-19 pandemic. It's about a group of people, 7 adults and a child, who shelter for several months in the country home of a Russian-born American writer in the Hudson Valley of New York. There are trysts, betrayals, mysterious threats from locals, even a blistering social media attack on the one famous member of the party. The New York Times' Molly Young called the book Steingart's finest yet, saying it's brilliant about so much: the humiliations of parenting and being parented, the sadism of chronic illness, the glory of friendship. The book is called Our Country Friends. Gary Steingart, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Great to be back. Thank you.
You know, as I noted in the introduction, you know, you come from a Russian Jewish family that had a lot of hardship, among them the fact that your father's father was killed in the defense of Leningrad in World War II, which meant your dad grew up with a stepfather who turned out to be very abusive. And, you know, those issues tend to cascade down through generations. And, you know, you're right that you grew up as an anxious kid. I mean, you came from, as you say, one declining superpower, the Soviet Union, where you were lied to all the time, and went to the United States, where you were in a different superpower with a lot of other problems. This book is about the pandemic and how a lot of people reacted. And I'm wondering, in your own life, did the pandemic, you think, trigger fears in you that it wouldn't in other people with more secure lives?
I would say that in some ways, the pandemic felt like normality to me because I've been so hardwired to expect the worst that when both the pandemic and the political crisis that overtook America around that time, when both of those things converged, I thought, I'm home, I'm back, you know, and being able to turn on the television and hear on some channels the same lies that we heard back in the Soviet Union, but from a different perspective, of course, all of that sounded very familiar to me. So the milieu that I operate in, and if you look at the books I've written, many of them, Super Sad True Love Story, for example, is this dystopian satire set in the future, but dealing very much with a kind of crisis, because the mode of crisis is the most familiar to me.
You compared the political crisis that accompanied the pandemic, well, coincided with the pandemic, I guess. You compared that to some of the lies you were told in the Soviet Union. Can you elaborate on that a little?
The point of the media in the Soviet Union was to make you believe what was clearly false before your very eyes. And Orwell wrote about that beautifully in 1984 and in other books. And I think when you turn on certain channels in the United States, it is clear both to the person's pronouncing the lie that he or she is lying, and then it's just a question of training the audience to believe that lie as well. So for me, I always thought that in the end, after 1991, after communism collapsed in the Soviet Union, that Russia would become more and more like America, develop a democracy, the rule of law. But again, what made this so familiar to me is that America became more and more like Russia, I think, in the last 4 or 5 years, a country where you can't really believe what you hear and what you see. So all of that was very inspirational when I was writing the novel, but it didn't become the novel because I didn't want to write a book about the political situation. I didn't want to write a book where the pandemic was everything. It was the entire source of consternation and concern for the characters in the book. I wanted to write a book about friendship because I was lonely up in the mid-Hudson Valley, living with my family, but having most of my friends far away. And so I began to populate the house I was living in with these 8 characters. And the fact that it coincided with the pandemic and the political crisis obviously made the situation a little bit more worrisome, more anxious for them. But the basic idea was really to see what I could do. This was sort of my pandemic project. I didn't make bread. I tried to populate a lonely place with the thing that I love the most, which is friendship.
Right. So the pandemic kind of created the setting for this sort of social experiment almost. Before the pandemic, you had a house in Dutchess County, New York, which is, I assume, a really pretty place in the Hudson Valley. Did you invite friends over to either stay or visit for socially distanced meals, whatever?
Well, before the pandemic, my house was sort of like a fresh air fund for my urban friends who would just come up, and we had a guest house and they would stay there for very long periods of time, which was wonderful. And we would all cook together and grill together. And it really reminded me of the happiest parts of my childhood. As you mentioned, I came here, I didn't know the language. But there was a Russian bungalow colony in Ellenville, New York, which is across the river from where I am in Dutchess. And it was populated by dozens of wonderful Russian kids who I remember so fondly. And we were learning English. We still spoke with an accent, but we were sort of assimilating into America in our own way, apart from all the kids that made fun of us back in our schools. So for me, upstate and a small upstate cabins are a kind of holy grail. It's when I close my eyes and think of something that's beautiful and safe. And I know this was the pandemic, but for me, it felt safe to be up there in every way possible. I am also asthmatic, and obviously COVID-19, of course, is not something that interacts well with asthma from what we know so far. But I would say that my favorite memories were of my friends coming over. And what I decided to do during the pandemic was to recreate it in my mind, because at this point, people weren't exactly traveling to each other's houses, at least not in the early part of the pandemic. But I do have some very good friends who live nearby, and we formed a kind of pandemic pod. There was five of us, myself, my wife, my child, and two very, very good friends, one a fellow novelist and one a director, a dramaturg at a theater in New York. And we just spent all so much time together, and it really restored my sanity. That and writing a book where I had all these characters romping around.
Yeah, Sasha Sendorovsky is the main character in the book. He's the one who owns the house that this group of friends stay at during the pandemic. He is a Russian-born novelist who was born in 1972 in Leningrad, as you were, right?
yes. Right what you know, as they say.
He has a cough from acid reflux. You grew up asthmatic. How much of you is in Sasha?
Well, I like to take people who are a little bit like the people I know, including myself, and to make little tweaks to them. So you have a character like Sasha. He's a novelist. He's a very failing novelist who's completely running out of money. That thankfully isn't me yet. Let me do a few more books before I achieve that kind of nosedive. But yes, he has certain problems. He has a wife who is a Russian psychiatrist. Some of my best friends are psychiatrists. I love psychiatrists. I have several. Then there's a Korean-American woman who's a kind of tech tycoon, and she has created this app called True Emotions, where people who use this app fall in love with each other. It's like a love potion, and it creates its own horrifying problems for everyone involved, including two of the characters in this book. Then there's a Korean dandy, an Indian-American failed writer. Then there's a woman from the South who writes these incendiary essays. And then finally, there is the actor. And the actor shows up, and he is a very beautiful, very famous actor who's working on a screenplay with Sasha Sendorovsky. And he is sort of, he sets the whole plot in motion, because he falls in love with one of the characters, and then another character falls in love with him. And then we have that whole Tolstoyan triangle thing, love triangle thing going. But he spurs on the plot.
Many of the characters are immigrants. As are you. This is a subject that you like to deal with a lot.
I mean, again, this is a very much a write what you know scenario. And, you know, my wife is the daughter of immigrants. My mentor, the Korean-American writer Chang-Rae Lee, was born in Seoul. And I would say at least way more than half of my friends are also of immigrant background, chiefly the same kind of people that populate this book, Korean-Americans, Gujarati-Americans, other folks from the subcontinent.
You know, I know that from your memoir and from your last appearance on Fresh Air that you went through a long period of your life where, as an adult, when you were writing, you were an angry man and not particularly empathetic. And a dear friend of yours wrote you a very candid letter describing this. And then you went through years of analysis and I think felt like you got to a lot better place. There is a betrayal in the center of this in which Sasha, the writer, the guy who's somewhat like you, we learn he, I don't know how much I want to give away here, but he kind of misled this friend of his about his own writing talent years before in a way that really kind of threw him off track. And it seems quite cruel when you kind of see it in the context of their lives together. And I wondered, is that rooted in something in your own life?
And thankfully, no. I have never destroyed a friend's career. In fact, what I try to blurb as many people as possible. I'm known as a kind of blurbing king. Somebody even made a documentary about my promiscuous blurbing, as it was put.
Blurbs being these little things at the back of books which say this is the best thing you've ever read.
Exactly, blurbs. Yes, the best thing since Tolstoy. The best thing since Jane Austen. Yeah, I'm full of those. If anyone has a book out there listening to this, please just send it to me. I'll blurb it right away. We'll just get that out of the way. Yes, but I think what you were mentioning before about growing up, I mean, I knew such cruelty as a child, both as the parent of immigrants who had themselves only known cruelty, and as a child who didn't speak English, who went to a school, a Jewish school where I was bullied, you know, morning till dusk. And there's no way that wouldn't be lodged in some part of my personality. So yes, in my 20s, I was certainly a very angry young man. Now, 20 years of psychoanalysis later, I hope I'm not as angry, because there's nothing worse than being an angry middle-aged man. That's very sad. I think, but for in terms of Sasha, even though he's married to a psychiatrist, I wanted him to be a little challenged in that empathy genre. And so although he loves his friends and he loves being social with his friends, he did commit in his late 20s this act of cruelty toward one friend. And only now, during this very long period of these eight friends being stuck together in this house, this thing began to bubble up and affect everyone's relationships.
A couple of things about the atmospherics in this novel that I noticed is you have a lot of fun making fun of these affluent New Yorkers like yourself and your friends who come to populate these rural communities, don't you?
Yes. I mean, this has been a hilarious trend even before predating the pandemic, but has definitely taken up a lot of steam since the pandemic. So little towns like Kingston, New York, Hudson, New York, are now being infiltrated at a very huge rate by people coming up from chiefly Brooklyn. I remember I was trying to renew my license in Kingston, and this woman came out with a bullhorn and said, "No people from Brooklyn. If you're from Brooklyn, please leave." and I think that really just completely captured the atmosphere. But to be fair, I've lived there for about 11 years.
Can I just interrupt you there? Was this someone from the DMV, an actual official person, saying you literally are not allowed to renew your license here if you're from Brooklyn?
Well, because they had so many, there was a problem with too many, the line was huge, and they were trying to get to people who actually lived in the area instead of were, you know, sort of carpet bagging up there. But I kind of felt for people who live there who are now being completely displaced. And I've been upstate for about 11 years. And I do spend most of my time there. So in some ways, I identify more with upstate than I do with the city. I have a child who goes to school in New York, so I do have to spend time here. But if I had my druthers, I would just be up there all the time. It's for a writer, it's magical. I mean, at this point, it doesn't really matter where I am. So, but I can write probably twice as fast upstate as I can here with all the noise and the parties and all the other stuff.
You know, a lot of the people who are in this colony of people who are there are people who have been friends or have had relationships that date back decades. And, you know, things happen in here. Changes occur among these. I mean, you know, betrayal and, you know, an unrequited love that takes a completely different turn after many, many years. And I wonder, as you thought about this and developed these things, I mean, do these things happen in this place in time simply because of this isolation and extended proximity to people who you've known forever but haven't spent this much time with? Or is it, you know, the threat of this invisible virus? I don't know. What's the catalyst for all this?
You know, it's interesting. I think that this pandemic has made people reconsider their lives. I know so many people who have changed careers, who have changed their conception of themselves, and sometimes their conception of themselves in relation to their friends. I see this and hear about this all the time. I think we were trying to shield ourselves from the pandemic, but we're also trying to discover who we were both as individuals and as groups. And this, I remember, I have a good friend of mine who lives in Germany, and she's left a couple of years ago, and we were always best friends, but because of the distance between us, we didn't talk as much. We certainly didn't see each other as much, but we would talk for hours during the pandemic and remember all these things that I had completely forgotten. And there's the two characters who remember that when they were growing up, when they were teenagers, they would talk to each other on the phone while watching The Simpsons, and they would sort of live play the way people now do on Twitter, you know, and say, "Oh my God, can you believe Mo just did this?" And, "Oh, look at Barney, he's drunk again," you know, and this is how we live. We'd sit there with our landlines and watch television together. And that's something the two characters discuss in the book. And I'd completely forgotten about all this. But I think there was, even though we were so far apart, people were so in need of knowing that other people exist, that one is loved, not just by family, but by greater circles of friends. It was very, very touching. And though I obviously operate in the field of humor, for me, that touching part was, it almost was the point, I almost felt like this is why I came to America in a way, was to make groups of friends like these, you know, to finally, even though I didn't belong as a child, but as an adult or as a young adult, to find the groups that would make me feel like I belong here, like I am an American.
It was interesting when you were describing how so many of these people from different immigrant backgrounds had parents that had expectations that didn't really fit with their lives in the States, and they tended to parent one another.
I imagine also that as their parents got older, they had similar issues kind of relating to and taking care of their parents.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think look, in some ways, we bring up immigrants, but in some ways, yes, every generation has these issues. And the Russian writer Turgenev wrote to me the definitive book about all that called Fathers and Sons, which I heartily recommend. It's a very short book, and it's absolutely lovely and hits on all of these issues. I think that also technology has interfered in this process, you know, because now, and this shows up in the book as well, you know, certain parents are getting so much misinformation, which is interesting, right? Because, you know, my parents grew up getting misinformation in the Soviet Union, and now here they are, and, you know, they've heard of things like critical race theory. They're not sure what it is, but they've been told it's very bad, you know? So they're constantly being fed this diet of propaganda the same way they were in the Soviet Union. And that's happening to a lot of parents who aren't immigrants, but also to a lot of parents who are immigrants, who may have come from societies where there was an authoritarian regime spreading misinformation. So the way we deal with our parents, first of all, I think has to come from a place of love, because now you understand more than ever just how much they were hurt by the societies from which they emerged, that they can't kind of pull it together, especially in times of crisis. Oddly enough, I think it's us, the children of immigrants, who both have the instinct to rise up during times of crisis because it's in our blood, but who also have the correct information to know what to do because we filter our information in a way that educated American people do.
Well, Gary Steingart, it's been fun. Thanks so much for speaking with us again.
Thank you so much. Always great to be here.
Gary Steingart's new novel, set during the pandemic, is called Our Country Friends. He spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. I'm Terry Gross.